In the matter of Liberty Insurance Corporation versus Tech Dan LLC, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Anthony J. Glowski, Denver, Chicago, on behalf of plaintiff cross appellants, Liberty Party.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Michael Malley from the law firm of Perry and Stewart on behalf of Amicus Curiae, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. John Morris, Princeton, New Jersey. I represent the what's referred to in the appellate division opinion, the TechDan defendants. TechDan, EES, your exterior, Mr. Dunlap, and I'm drawing a blank on the last one.
Fisher.
There we go. This shows you what his involvement was.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Carney on behalf of Carol.
Counsel, welcome. Justice Solomon is participating in this matter, and we'll be watching the tape. Mr. Glowski, please go ahead. We're going to try to break, as I said, at 12:30 or so.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve no more than 5 minutes at the end for rebuttal, if necessary.
Hopefully a little less. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Your Honors, we are asking this Court to reverse the judgment of the Appellate Division and reinstate the trial court's judgment. As we explain in our pleadings, the Appellate Division was wrong to reverse the trial court's judgment because it was not a mistake for the trial court not to give an ultimate outcome instruction on the IFPA charge in this case, and it was not a mistake not to give the jury an allocation instruction, especially here where there were no cross claims for contribution and indemnification on behalf of any of the defendants. The statutes at issue, we believe, call for joint and several liability. The jury's findings were clear. And most importantly here, every party wants the jury's verdict upheld. Every party agrees that the jury got it right. What the issue seems to be is, what does it mean? What does it mean when parties violate two insurance fraud statutes and when parties commit conspiracy to commit insurance fraud? Are they liable for the consequences of their actions? That's essentially what the issue is. The defendants argue that there should be no personal liability on the part of any of the individual defendants. And we disagree with that. Separate and apart from the restitution issues, the fraud statutes are clear. The workers' compensation fraud statute provides that a party who violates that act is responsible for the victim's damages and attorney's fees and costs. Those fees and costs are mandated by statute. Likewise, with the Insurance Fraud Prevention Act, a party who violates that act is liable to the insurer for damages and also for attorney's fees and costs. And if there is a pattern of fraud act violations, those fees and costs are trebled. Well, in this case, every party agrees that the jury got it right. So with regard to count one, the workers' compensation fraud statute, for the two of the individual defendants were found liable along with the corporate defendants. Those individuals are Dunlap and Jones. Mr. Fisher was not found liable under the statutes. But when you put your hand up and say, yes, I agree with the jury, I did commit workers' compensation fraud, you can't be heard to argue that I'm not responsible for the attorney's fees and costs that come with that by virtue of the statute. Likewise, when you violate the IFPA and you agree, yes, I did, I violated the IFPA, you can't be heard to argue I'm not responsible for the fees and costs that are mandated by statute, nor the treble damages when the jury says you committed a pattern of fraud act violations and you say I agree. So the imposition of the fees and costs in this case, the calculation was made by the trial judge, as was his purview. All parties knew after the partial summary judgment was entered that fees and costs would be decided after trial, decided by the trial judge, and that was done. It's approximately $1 million in fees and costs. The defendants did not challenge that allocation. So what the trial judge did, because that was his purview, he calculated the fees and costs, awarded it against the four defendants who violated the two statutes, and trebled it pursuant to the pattern of IFPA violations. That was never an issue for the jury to decide, and the appellate division ignored that. They ignored it completely, which is contrary to the language of the statute. What all parties in this case want, because no one wants the case to be retried because everyone is satisfied with the liability findings, and we submit it's contrary to the language of the statute and the legislative intent behind the Insurance Fraud Prevention Act. Likewise, when the defendants were found, again, Dunlap and Jones were found guilty or liable for committing a civil conspiracy, this court has said co-conspirators are jointly and severally liable. The appellate division not only ignored that, but the appellate division says conspiracy should be decided under the Comparative Negligence Act. Now, that's contrary to binding precedent by this court, and it certainly wasn't the law when Judge Rogers issued the judgment in this case. There's no basis to overturn the judgment. You have a conspiracy. Dunlap and Jones conspired. They caused the damages that Liberty sustained, which the jury agreed with Liberty was the 100% of the $756,990 of premium sought. The jury agreed with that. And Judge Rogers took that conspiracy finding and imposed joint and several liability. And the appellate division said he was wrong for doing so. We disagree. Likewise, it was the jury, not Judge Rogers, who decided that the corporate veil should be pierced as to Robert Dunlap and that Robert Dunlap was liable under director and officer liability. But for the IFPA charge, the jury was given an ultimate outcome instruction on every other charge. So the jury was told Liberty wants personal liability for the owners of the company or the directors of the company, depending on the charge. And the jury made a decision. They said, director and officer liability, Dunlap, yes, Fisher, no. Piercing the corporate veil, Dunlap, yes, Fisher, no. It was pretty clear. The jury made that finding. They allocated the premium to the corporate entities because they were told that premium was the measure of damages. The corporations signed the contracts, the insurance policies, and were responsible for the damages. So when the corporations were found liable, the owner and director of those companies was personally liable. And that's what the judge did. And that's what the appellate division.
Let me ask you a question. You're finished with your opening statement, I assume.
No, but please.
Continue.
No, please. I'll take your question. I'm happy to.
Thank you. I was confused when I saw in the trial court's opinion and then in your brief, and you just mentioned it again, this idea that you need a cross-claim for contribution and indemnification in order for the Comparative Negligence Act to apply. I've been admitted a long time, but the whole time I've been admitted, the law has been, at least since Young versus Lotta, that there is no requirement, specifically no requirement, for a cross-claim for contribution and indemnification to be filed in order for the Comparative Negligence Act with its nexus to the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Act, which is part of the equation, in order for there to be an allocation of fault among joint defendants. So where is this cross-claim issue?
I think in conjunction with your answer to your question, the answer is, what were the proofs at trial, right? So there was no proof. First of all, the appellate division decided the insurance company should be on the verdict sheet. There was no proof or allegations of any kind that the insurance company did anything wrong.
I mean, I'm going to ask you a more fundamental question.
Yes.
Because you are arguing here that there is a requirement of a cross-claim in order to get an allocation under the Comparative Negligence Act and the Joint Tortfeasors Contribution Act. And the whole point of Young versus Lotta, and it's been, you know, repeated ad nauseum in many, many cases over the years, is there is no such requirement as long as there's notice, and the requirements are set forth in that case and in some subsequent cases. So why are you arguing that?
I think to be more specific, it's related to the facts of this case. It's the evidence before. I'm not looking to reset precedent on an issue that wasn't in my case. It's in this case.
Let me ask you then, are you taking the position that if there's no cross-claim, there can't be an allocation?
No, I can't take that position. If the Comparative Negligence Act applies, I can't take that position, but I don't believe it applies for a number of reasons. And in this case, when you look at the evidence that was presented at trial, there was no evidence submitted at all that would support an allocation. There was no finger pointing.
No, an allocation, but you can have and it happens routinely, and obviously your firm is tremendously involved with multi-defendant cases and has done great work in that area. You don't have to have the plaintiff's negligence to be on the issue or a prima facie claim of the plaintiff's negligence in order to get an allocation among defendants under the Comparative Negligence Act.
I don't disagree with Your Honor. And I think the question really is, does it apply? I mean, one of the issues that I think...
Why doesn't it apply to your case?
Here's why I think it doesn't apply, for two reasons. I think you have two potentially competing statutes. Number one is, when you look at the plain language of the workers' compensation fraud statute, what that statute provides is, any person who violates this act is liable to the victim for, and I'm paraphrasing, but any person who violates the act is liable to the victim for damages, attorney's fees.
Consumer Fraud Act does all that.
I understand.
And the Consumer Fraud Act, there's an allocation of fault among defendants in an appropriate case.
Because this court has decided, and remember in Gennari v. Weikert, this court decided that that would be the case. Prior to this appellate division holding, no court has ever said in an IFPA case that there should be an allocation. In fact, in the unpublished opinion in Land, after this court heard Liberty Mutual v. Land, the appellate division actually affirmed the finding of joint and several liability that the trial court decided.
But you agree that torts, generally, including intentional torts, are subject to allocation?
I think there's a problem between torts in general, and when you look at what the Comparative Negligence Act is meant to deal with, and when you look at concerted effort in a fraud case. That's where I have a problem. I understand that you can call conspiracy an intentional tort. I think the problem is this. Law is not one size fits all. Different causes of action have different burdens of proof. In different cases, you do or don't do different things. So, for example, this court has decided on two separate occasions, in Wanatic versus Gateway Mitsubishi and in Roman v. Mitchell, that a trial judge retains the discretion whether to charge the ultimate outcome charge.
Just to be clear, I'm not going to ultimate outcome.
I know.
The basic threshold determination, which the appellate division has said the answer is yes, is to whether there should be an allocation among defendants under the Comparative Negligence Act. And I could see if you wanted to say it's intentional, but that ship has sailed, right? Intentional torts can be subject to allocation under the Comparative Negligence Act.
I agree they can be. I don't think they always have to be, because if conspiracy is an intentional tort, this court has said joint and several liability applies. Joint and several liability benefits the victim. That's Scatino v. Roisman. The allocation benefits the defendant.
A joint and several liability cases are the cases that are subject to the Comparative Negligence Act.
But only one person can ever be jointly and severally liable under that theory, right? One person who's 60% liable.
The legislature has decided that joint and several liability will go this way. If you are up to the 60%, right? If you're up to the 60% level, you're at 20% fault, you're at 10, you're at 59, you are only responsible for the percentage of fault that the jury allocates to you, right? That's what the legislature said. After 60, if you have somebody who's judgment proof, you may be on the hook for the whole thing. But these are all joint and several liability cases that the legislature has made a determination based on concepts of fairness and other aspects of legislative history, that this is how we're going to do it. To say that these people are joint and severally liable doesn't mean that they can't be subject to allocation.
Well, okay, so I think what you have here are two competing statutes that this court has a chance to reconcile. So, for example, you've got a statutory Workers' Comp Fraud Act that says anyone who violates is liable. It's not talking about, I mean, the clear language to me says if five of you violate, five of you are liable. There's no implied allocation in there, right? When allocation doesn't benefit the victim, it benefits the defendant.
Doesn't proximate cause enter into the damages assessment? In this particular case, the jury charge does not explain causation at all. I'm not sure why it's omitted, but it wasn't there. So if you go to the verdict sheet on compensatory damages, which is page 795, and you probably here you have it handy.
Yeah.
So or page 4 of the document itself, right? If your answer was yes as to liability against any defendant, specify the amount of damages that you award to plaintiff against that particular defendant, that is the amount of lost insurance premiums, and you go down And the jury did specify the amount of damages. Mr. Dunlop, zero. Mr. Fisher, zero. Ms. Juntz, zero. So when you started out telling us that everybody in this case agrees with the jury verdict, well, they've determined, even without proximate cause being charged to them, that these individual defendants did not cause numerical damage. So aren't we required to respect that because maybe they found that, you know, it was really the company's action. The company was the proximate cause, not these individuals personally. That may not make sense in the facts of the case, but aren't we required, if you say you agree with the verdict, to accept 000?
Yeah, I anticipated that question, Your Honor. Yes, I think if you want to say, you know what, both sides, you live with the sword, you die by the sword, then that means that the attorney's fees and costs that flow from the statute must be applied against the four defendants who violated those acts. If you're going to say to the plaintiff, you know what, those zeros are there, except for Mr. Dunlap, who owes $75,000, which gets trebled. Other than that $225,000, we're going to find zero because the jury decided that the corporations who they were told owe the premium, owe the premium. The next question then would be, what flows from the findings of personal liability under piercing the corporate veil and director liability? Was the trial judge wrong when the jury was told Liberty wants personal liability and the jury said yes on two counts as to Mr. Dunlap? Does that combined 757, a portion of which he's already liable for, doesn't that flow to him by virtue of the jury's findings?
A proximate cause charge, as you probably know, tells the jury that they should consider whether each defendant was a substantial factor in producing the damage. So going forward, in other cases like this, is it appropriate to include or exclude a proximate cause charge that would ask the jurors to look at each defendant's conduct and evaluate, was that person's conduct a substantial factor? And if it wasn't, then it is zero. If it were, then we get down to the percentage. Well, and going forward, isn't that the appropriate way for the jury to be charged in cases like this?
I can't agree to a bright line, and I will tell you why. Because when I think of proximate cause, I first think of negligence. And I think of the practical applications of how the appellate division's decision can be applied. So if you look at concerted actions, in a case like this, you have an application that was prepared by a broker with information provided by Defendant Juntz and signed by Defendant Fisher with false information, all with the approval of Defendant Dunlap. If you urge or conspire someone to prepare a false document, you violated the Fraud Act. So, but for the participation of the three of them, there is no application fraud. These false statements that were signed by each of the defendants to bring Exterior Erecting into the policy. But for the false actions of each of the three of them, Exterior isn't brought on. Then you have the premium fraud, where there are false tax returns prepared, and you have false payroll records prepared, and the auditors are given false information. The problem with something like that, where you've got concerted effort, is how do you allocate fraud? And I thought of an example because I was thinking, how does this appellate division opinion play out, including the part where you put the plaintiff on the verdict sheet? A real case. Man is walking his dog on the street, hears a noise, two cars have a front-end collision. The drivers get out, they look at the cars, they don't see any damage, they drive away. 5 minutes later, they come around the block again and hit each other harder. Each car has a driver and three passengers. There are four property damage claims, four bodily injury claims for PIP benefits, and then eight lawsuits back and forth. You've got doctors who were involved, you've got runners who were involved. You have that kind of concerted effort where everybody participated in the fraud. The first thing is, what possible basis can you have to put the insurance company on a verdict sheet in a case like that? And second of all, where all the actors acted in concert.
Let me ask you, does the appellate division specifically say that the plaintiff should be on the verdict sheet?
Yes.
I thought it simply said that that there should be an allocation among the parties.
It's that every party, including plaintiff, which is interesting because in those personal injury cases, if there is a counterclaim for contributory negligence or a set-off defense for contributory negligence, If there is no evidence at trial, the plaintiff can move for a directed verdict and say, don't put that on the verdict sheet.
If the case, this case were to be retried, what would be wrong with having it as a normal, well, just to step back, in a normal situation like you were talking about where you have a claim of comparative negligence, the trial court can get to the end of the evidence and say that there's nothing here that suggests this plaintiff was negligent, and the plaintiff doesn't go on the verdict sheet.
I agree.
Is your objection here to the appellate division suggesting that the plaintiff belongs on the verdict sheet, or are you objecting more broadly to the application of an allocation among the defendants?
I think there's two parts of it. Again, going back to the facts of this case, because this is the case that I have, not looking prospectively, but we have a case where there was no request for allocation by the defendants until 6 weeks after the case was tried. A strategic decision was made. It didn't work out the way they wanted it to, although they say they're happy with the verdict. 6 weeks later, the issue is raised. But nobody wants to retry the case. Everybody wants the findings to apply. I don't believe in this case. It should have, first of all. Second of all, with regard to with regard to the statutes, and specifically the workers' compensation fraud statute on this issue, because I think the language of that statute is the more clear. If a statute says anybody who violates owes, right? And I understand the reason for that. The reason for these fraud statutes is because fraud is a significant problem in New Jersey. This court has called it massive. In the amicus brief, we saw $40 billion a year was the statistic provided. And you've got an IFPA that for years and years has been getting stronger and stronger. I think if you start allocating damages in a case like this, and if you insist that the plaintiff go on the verdict sheet, what you're going to do is you're going to weaken the Fraud Act when I don't think that was the intent.
But that's the heart of my question here, because if the Comparative Negligence Act and the allocation process applies, then there's no requirement of putting anybody on the verdict sheet because there has to be a certain amount of evidence that's offered, which is sufficient for the jury to allocate fault, and the jury has to actually make a determination that there's fault on behalf of all those parties. So are you fundamentally objecting to the application of the Comparative Negligence Act to these cases, and in which case, what's the basis for it, given the broad statutory language? Or are you objecting to your client being on the verdict sheet?
I'm objecting. Under the facts of this case, I don't think our decision should have been reversed when, based on issues that were never raised at trial and that have subsequently been stated by the defendants to have been non-prejudicial. So,
a general proposition, leaving your case aside, do you disagree that the broad language of the Comparative Negligence Act and the case law that this court has over the years developed about intentional torts would indicate that as a general principle, the Comparative Negligence Act applies to these insurance fraud cases?
That's the guidance that I'm looking for this court to provide. I will argue on behalf of my clients and on the insurance industry that I think taking away joint and several liability in these fraud cases undermines the intent of statutes who have a clear legislative history of trying to combat fraud. So I would answer candidly to Your Honor, yes, I don't think there should be allocation on the statutory fraud claims. I also don't think there should be allocation on conspiracy based on this court's holding in Banco Popular v. Gandhi. On the common law claims, I can't disagree with you. I see what the court has ruled in other cases. I see what you ruled in the case of the Consumer Fraud Act. I understand that the history is for this court to expand the scope of the Comparative Negligence Act. I recognize
that. I wouldn't suggest expanding it. We're interpreting a statute. We didn't write it. We're interpreting a statute. And we're... there's very broad language in that statute about the application of the. So, am I understanding your argument to be that in this case, A, there should be no requirement by the appellate division that the trial court, if the case were to be retried on some level, would have to put the plaintiff on the verdict sheet, and B, you're saying there was not sufficient notice under Young versus Lotta and the subsequent cases that the defendants intended to seek an allocation against one another?
Yes to both. And I think
there's no settling defendant, so they don't have to give the early notice for a settling defendant.
Correct. And I do. I see fundamentally, I do see a difference, which I want to be candid with you on all issues. I do see a difference between the negligence case where maybe you've got a plaintiff who jaywalks and gets hit by a car and then gets hit by another car. And maybe somebody comes and pushes him down again and you've got an intentional tortfeasor and you're looking at who caused what damages. I understand why you're allocating in a case like that. I do think when you've got somebody who violates a statute and the statute says, if you violate this statute, you owe. It doesn't say you owe in tandem with others, right? So when you talk about interpreting statutes, I know this court has said that the IFPA should be interpreted liberally in order to give effect to its provisions, because insurance fraud is serious. I mean, it's a statute that over its 40-year history has gotten stronger and stronger, and this court has recognized
it. So is the Consumer Fraud Act.
Yes.
And that law, and you know, everything you said about the IFPA could be applied to the CNA.
I agree with you, Your Honor, and I think that's why I said that this court has a chance to prospectively reconcile two potentially competing statutes, but this court has never said before today, and maybe you will say after today, maybe you will say that we're going to apply CNA allocation in every case involving both of those two fraud statutes, and we're even going to apply it in conspiracy cases overruling Banco.
Let me ask you one more thing, because I don't want to confuse two different concepts here.
Right.
There's a requirement for defendants to provide notice if there's a settling defendant. That's been in a lot of cases over the years, right? The defendant has to not surprise the plaintiff at trial. They have to give notice prior to trial. And everybody has to be clear that this defendant is settled. We're going to try to prove the case against that. But I'll tell you, I've never heard of a notice requirement to just allocate among defendants who are in the case. It's just done by the trial court.
Well, I don't think anyone believed here that it applied, Your Honor. I mean, on the summary judgment.
But I understand. I just don't want to mix up two different things, because I would be with you if you were to say you never got notice about a settling defendant and all of a sudden the empty chair is being tried in this case with you, because there is a notice requirement. But we're talking about no settling defendant. They're all there at the time the jury gets the case, right? So there's no tell me if I'm wrong. I'm not aware of any notice requirement that a defendant has to say, we want an allocation among these defendants. And if nobody asks for it, doesn't happen. The trial court does that as a matter of course.
And I believe it's if it thinks it applies, and it clearly didn't, and none of the parties apparently thought it applied either. You know, the case may have been tried completely differently had that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. A quick follow-up to Justice Patterson's question. So if the CNA does apply, what's your position on retrial on liability only?
I don't think it should be necessary. I think, first of all, if it applies, it should be prospective.
Because the parties waived somehow?
Yes. So I will say, again, just with regard to the ultimate outcome, plaintiff put that in its jury charges. Defendants did not. The trial judge removed it. He exercised his discretion. The defendants made a strategic decision not to do otherwise.
I'm not talking about ultimate outcome. I'm talking about the comparative negligence act itself. If that applies,
yes.
There's still no need to retry the case on liability?
I don't believe so. I mean, if the appellate division thought retrial was necessary when nobody wanted it, they could have remanded it for much on a much less drastic basis, right? It could have been liability has been decided. We shouldn't need to try liability again. If we were going to go back and we just had to try damages, they also found though that the damages were 100% of the premium.
It wasn't resolved through some kind of allocation scheme. There's no percentages of fault.
Say that again, Your Honor.
Was there any percentage of fault attributed to these defendants by the jury?
No.
No. So how can the judge mold the verdict then if the Comparative Negligence Act applies?
I guess the question is if it applies. And when you
look... I'm saying, assume for the sake of my question, it does.
Okay.
What happens? Practically speaking, what do we do at that point?
Well, right. There are practical issues. I guess on the one hand, we'd have to go back and the plaintiff would have to argue, who's got the burden of proof then on allocation? Should it be the defendants? And can they now, you know, what do you do when one attorney represents four defendants?
That's why I asked about retrial on liability only. Is that the solution?
I don't think it should be. I mean, here's one of the problems, right? There's the prejudice issue. The issues were waived at trial. The plaintiff, in a case that's now 10 years old, the plaintiff went through a three-week trial. These issues were never raised. The plaintiff got a judgment that it believes it won on because the jury found for the plaintiff against one or more defendants on every count. The appellate division says the trial court didn't do this and the defendants didn't do that, but they don't blame the plaintiff for doing anything. So this insurance company that lost $757,000 of premium spent a lot of money trying to prove the fraud in this case, has a judgment that's now taken away when the statutory fees and costs shouldn't be subject to discretion anyway.
Didn't the jury already make an affirmative allocation? It said zero for each of the individual defendants. And then they had numbers that allocated between the two corporate defendants. It's not like there was something missing from the verdict sheet. They affirmatively said zero, 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 and then these numbers for the two corporate entities. Isn't that inherently an allocation?
Well, then so would be the punitive damages. Where
right, we'll put those aside for the moment. I understand that. But in terms of the compensatory damages, they've already indicated their allocation, haven't they?
As to the companies, I mean, the instruction they were given is premium is the measure of damages and premium was owed by the companies. So this, what this jury did was they allocated the premium to the two insured defendants. You know, Daniel Fisher individually didn't owe premium. He was not the insured. Tech Dan and Exterior were the insureds, and that's what the jury did. They put the premium dollars allocated between the two companies.
I want to follow up on Judge Vasciali's question, and we understand your position. Give guidance for the future, and no need for a retrial here if the CNA applies. If we don't accept those arguments, and the court were to send it back for a new trial, and finding that the contributory negligence act should apply, what would need to be retried?
Well, I don't think the statutory fraud would need to be retried. Statutory fraud issues.
The IFPA issue?
The IFPA and the workers' compensation fraud statute. Many of these questions are yes-no questions. Did a defendant violate this act, yes or no? I mean, almost all the questions, personal liability. Were Dunlap and Fisher liable for, you know, under a piercing the corporate veil theory? Dunlap, yes, Fisher, no. What about director liability? Dunlap, yes, Fisher, no. Those yes or no questions are not subject to allocation. They shouldn't be.
If you think about how a jury instruction and verdict sheet is constructed in a case where the Comparative Negligence Act applies, there is a threshold determination. The jury is told, is Mr. X liable, or is Mr. X negligent, or did Mr. X, have the elements been proven as to Mr. X? And if they answer no, they are not instructed to put that person on the list of parties that are subject to an allocation of fraud.
Right.
So could you make an argument that for those determinations, yes or no, as to whether the case had been proven against a given defendant, those don't have to be retried. The only thing that has to be retried is the allocation of fault among those defendants who were found to be liable under either a statutory or a common law claim.
Yeah. Yes, and to follow up on Judge Sabatino's question, in answer to your question, with regard to piercing the corporate veil and director's liability, where there was only one person found liable, there's no need for an allocation. There's one person. That doesn't need to be retried. The jury spoke and found Mr. Dunlap liable under both theories. There's no one to allocate to. And if I understand Your Honor's question is, what do we retry? Then the question would be then with regard to the four defendants who were found liable, and the corporations don't appear to be appealing, it's the individuals. So the question is, as between Dunlap and Jones, who were found liable on the two fraud statutes, how do we allocate their liability?
Well, it should be the corporations who are on there as well, shouldn't it?
Well, it can be. I mean,
if you're going to preserve what you could from this trial, and that is the yes or no answer on whether the elements of the cause of action were proven against a given defendant, then wouldn't both categories of defendants as to which the jury found liability?
This is one of the practical problems with that decision. So you've got four defendants, two corporations who have been defunct for years. You say to, and corporations are intangible entities. They don't make statements. Individuals make statements on their behalf. The false statements in this case were made by Daniel Fisher, Robert Dunlap, Carol Jones. There's no person Tech Dan, right? But the problem is when you look at the goal of the IFPA, which is to recover lost premium dollars, you're going to put four defendants on a verdict sheet, and you're going to say, well, who's liable? If the jury finds 25% each, two corporations are defunct. There's half the recovery gone, and you've got to decide between Dunlap and Jones, which of the two. If the jury comes out 50-50, nobody is 100% liable, but you've had your judgment watered down because two defunct intangibles.
That's how the Comparative Negligence Act operates. It just does that sometimes.
Well, I think then it's contrary to the intent of the IFPA in this case, where the goal of the IFPA is to allow the insurance company to recover fraudulently obtained benefits.
Were they defunct as of the time of trial?
Tech Dan certainly was. It's questionable whether Exterior was. They said it was.
Counsel, would you like to address briefly the ultimate outcome charge?
Yes, I think with regard to the ultimate outcome charge, so on every charge but the IFPA, the ultimate outcome was given. The jury understood what Liberty wanted. At the time this case was decided, it was not a requirement to give an ultimate outcome charge in an IFPA case. I understand that the appellate division relied on Wanatic v. Gateway Mitsubishi to say, well, the CFA is the closest statutory analog to the IFPA, therefore we find that it was wrong for the trial judge not to do it. But
can I ask a question? Are you referring to a charge that says to the jury we have an allegation piercing the corporate veil, and if you decide to pierce the corporate veil, then the individual is liable?
No,
is that what you're referring to as an ultimate outcome charge?
Yeah, they were told the consequences of what does it mean when you find.
Right. But is that really the ultimate outcome charge under the CFA is the damages are going to be trebled. So if you give 1,000, they're really going to collect 3 folks. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that nomenclature, but it seems like those are two different kinds of charges. And I frankly never heard of a corporate veil charge being referred to as an ultimate outcome charge.
No, what I mean is there was an instruction that told the jury, for everything we want you to find, this is the consequence. So if you find there are co-conspirators, they can be held liable for the conduct of one another. Aiding and abetting, they can be held liable for the conduct of one another.
Sort of the basic ultimate outcome charge is the one that says that if you find the plaintiff 51% negligent, they're out of luck, right? That was the original ultimate outcome charge.
Right.
But I just had never heard the sort of corporate veil type instruction as referred to as ultimate outcome, because it doesn't say damages are not going to be awarded. It says they're going to be found liable for whatever you find them liable for.
Well, and same thing with the IFPA. And the issue, the reason we phrased it this way is because the IFPA, the appellate division made that dispositive. So, for example, on the workers' comp fraud statute, the jury was told if a person violates this act, they owe restitution and attorney's fees. The IFPA instruction does not contain similar language. It does not tell the jury that if you find a pattern of fraud act violations, that there will be treble damages. The instruction does not say that. The defendants never moved for it. That was their elected trial strategy. They didn't complain until 6 weeks after trial. There was never any chance for the plaintiff to address that after the fact. So the trial judge had discretion. This court said in two separate cases, in a complex case with multiple parties and multiple issues, the trial judge can withhold the ultimate outcome charge.
Didn't the pretrial judge, Judge Miller, make a ruling? I haven't seen an order in the file, but didn't he make a ruling that there would be an ultimate outcome charge given? Or am I
Judge Miller decided that on summary judgment, which is why we included it in our instructions, and defendants did not, and the trial judge the trial judge heard the case. He went through 3 weeks of trial, and he decided, there were no jury instructions when Judge Miller decided in 2017. There was no verdict sheet, and Judge Rogers said, I felt under the facts of this case that I did not need to give it. He exercised his discretion, which the court says he has. No one argued it was an abuse of discretion, but the appellate division said, well, if it applies in CFA cases, it should have been done here. Reversed. And our position is, look, Justice Patterson asked about the Comparative Negligence Act. I understand that with regard to Consumer Fraud Act, this court made a specific decision. While the trial judge retains jurisdiction, and we repeat the important caveat in Roman v. Mitchell, we say today, going forward in all Consumer Fraud Act cases, you must give an ultimate outcome charge. And if that's the case, then same here. The court can say—
You're saying it was never requested here. By them.
Never requested by them. And this
was included in the written proposed charge that you had for the judge?
That we did, yes.
Do we have that in the record?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
And he elected not to charge it.
Okay.
And there were no objections to that. But more importantly, the trial judge had that discretion. If the court says, you know, next week, going forward, in all IFPA cases, we think that should be done, then we're asking you to apply that ruling prospectively.
When you included that in your charges, did you think that that was a charge that should be given as a general proposition?
I didn't have an objection to it, but Judge Miller said we said it should be there, and we did not...
Following his order.
Right. We did not want to be called out for disobeying an order.
I think we have your position on that.